I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. It's our pleasure to have Richard Florida with us today, and we have so much to talk about. He is the author now of a new book, The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. He writes about many things, but one of the overall themes is that he looks at the big, rich cities, the tech hubs, the cities like New York, London, Paris, San Francisco, that face what he calls a crisis of success. As the affluent and the educated have come back to the cities, we're seeing more poverty now in the suburbs, actually, than in the cities. Housing prices have risen, and they have become less affordable and certainly more divided. A much larger group of cities, including the old Rust Belt cities and sprawling Sun Belt places, he writes, are still economically challenged. So he looks at what's happening, and you can see it in so many cities. I can see it from outside my window here in Milwaukee, what's happening in certain parts of downtown. And young people who have very successful jobs are getting nice condos along the river, incredible amount of construction, and yet you look at what's happening a few blocks from where we are, and people are struggling. There's a great deal of poverty. There isn't very much movement into the middle class, to say nothing of moving into a more affluent class. So there's a lot to talk about this hour. And Richard is the university professor and director of cities at the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Management. He's distinguished fellow at NYU's Institute of Real Estate. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, editor at large for the Atlantic City Lab, and founder of the Creative Class Group. And we've already told you the name of his book. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll have many during the course of this hour. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Richard Florida, hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. What's unbelievable, and you've written about this, there are some cities, and I think about San Francisco as a case in point, where I don't know how people can afford to live there, Richard. The housing, let's start with housing. The housing there, you've got to be a wealthy person in order to live in San Francisco.
Well, indeed. I mean, you said it in your intro so eloquently. You know, in the past, I've written all about the urban revival, mm-hmm, and the role of the knowledge workers, the young people, the professionals, the people, like you said, you see moving downtown in Milwaukee,
right,
the creative class. And, maybe over the past 10 or 15 years since I wrote that book, it actually worked too well. This has become really a hyper-successful thing, the movement of people back downtown. And in a place like San Francisco, it went from being, kind of on the expensive side. San Francisco has always been an expensive city, to a place that's, completely unaffordable. And in my book, I have a chart. I could have used San Francisco, but I used Soho in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, for one apartment in Soho, 2,000 square foot apartment in Soho, not very big, how many houses could you buy somewhere else? And, I don't have the chart in front of me, but it's like, 10 houses in Boston,
oh my
20
gosh,
houses in Atlanta, and like 50 houses in Detroit.
Ooh.
I mean, it just goes on and on. But, the point is, for the price of one condominium in San Francisco, you could probably buy 10 or 20 houses, beautiful houses, in Milwaukee. So it's become very, very unaffordable and very unequal.
Yeah. And so what happens to all of those people? Most people don't make a whole lot of money, as we know. They're middle-class people. They're, working, they're teachers. They're people who work at hospitals. They're police officers. They're middle-class kinds of jobs. Where are those people? What's happening to those people? They can't afford to live in fancy, high-rises or luxurious condos in Milwaukee or anywhere else now.
Well, Kathleen, and for folks listening, and that is a big, big question, and I wrote a whole book about it.
But I know.
Let me try
we have a whole hour, Richard.
Let me try to be as to the point as I can, and again, we can dig into it. First thing that we know, because the research that's been done shows this, that this urban revival kicks off really about the year 2000. So basically the time I wrote my book, Rise of the Creative Class, about the urban revival. In that past 15 or 17 years, it's the top 10% of income earners who've moved back into cities And it's the bottom 10 of income earners who've moved out.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I say in my book, it's this third of the economy who are members of the knowledge class, the professional class, the creative class. We actually do this. We look at the cost, how much money they have left over after paying for housing. They still can afford. Maybe they're not in the center of the city. Maybe they're in an adjacent neighborhood. Maybe they're not in the best neighborhood. But even in the San Franciscos and New York, they can do okay. It's the remaining 66%, those blue-collar workers, those service workers who work in daycare or health care or retail, you know, shops or work in food preparation and services. They are falling further and further behind. And one of the points I make in the book, I think it's a big point, and gets to the thing that you were just talking about. The old urban crisis, you know, which was felt in Milwaukee, was felt in Chicago, was felt in Detroit, was really about the flight of the middle class from the urban center to the then new suburban dream. The new urban crisis, as I define it, now there are several dimensions, but the central one is that the middle class is becoming annihilated across the board. And the statistic I quote is telling. In 1970, more than three-quarters of Americans lived in middle-class neighborhoods, like the one I grew up in New Jersey, and now, you know, less than 40%, maybe as few as a third of us do. So it's really the middle class that has been terribly squeezed and priced out of these communities.
You also cite some other remarkable statistics. This one just knocks me out. Today, there are more poor people in the suburbs than there are in the cities, 17 million versus 13.5 million.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a big dimension why the new urban crisis just doesn't conform to city boundaries. That really it is metropolitan wide, and this decline of the middle class. And really, you know, one of the things I devote a whole chapter to the crisis of the suburbs, and there is more poverty now in suburbs than there is in cities, and poverty is growing at a faster rate in suburbs. And mainly because as the urban neighborhoods become recolonized by more higher-income people and higher-income groups, poverty and distress gets pushed out to the suburbs. And I think the way I like to think about this is our society is split not only between the rich and poor, but between small areas of concentrated advantage in our suburbs. You know, our suburbs are still home to the richest neighborhoods in America. I have that list in my book. Yes, there's some urban neighborhoods like Soho and Greenwich Village in New York and some in San Francisco, but the suburbs are still home to the richest and most expensive neighborhoods in America. But now, increasingly, they are home to some of the poorest. And the point is that this split between areas of concentrated advantage and much larger areas of concentrated disadvantage spans both city and suburb. And I think those terms are maybe even starting to lose their meaning. I call it we live in a patchwork metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really what we're seeing is our society split into urban areas and suburban areas where the wealthy and the advantaged live, and urban and suburban area where disadvantaged people live. And, you know, a story that I tell in the book is I went to dinner. I live in Toronto part of the year. I'm an American, but I live in Toronto. There's a lakes region, kind of like the Wisconsin lakes region, you know, Great Lakes, but there's a fresh lakes region outside of Toronto called the Muskokas, and a lot of people from New York, because they want to avoid summer in the city, they come up to this area, which is quite pristine and natural. And I went to dinner with two couples. One was from an urban center like Soho. The other was from Greenwich. And they kept arguing about, you know, I live in the city and you live in a suburb and my city neighborhood's cooler than your suburban neighborhood and my suburban neighborhood's nicer than this. And I said, you guys live in the same neighborhood. You shop at the same darn Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. You send your kids to the same kind of private schools. Mm-hmm. You decorate your apartments and houses the same way. One says a suburb, one says an urban. And I think that's what's happening. We're either living in advanced urban areas or advantaged suburban areas or disadvantaged urban and suburban areas. And in a way, those old boundaries of city and suburb don't hold as much weight as they used to.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the competition now and who's winning in this game. The competition, and I'm not even sure what all of these, you know, venture capital companies and all these high-tech companies. I'm not sure what everybody's doing, but it's obvious that everybody wants them. And you write about just one small sliver of downtown San Francisco attracting billions of dollars in venture capital annually. And so all the cities, I would imagine, all over the country and really all over the world, the bigger cities, are trying to get these companies to move to their little area. Who's winning and why are they winning? Do they just have a lot of money to attract them?
Well, in the book, we've all heard, or many of us have heard, I don't want to assume everyone's heard, but that this idea of a winner-take-all economy, that the idea that the top superstar athletes, you know, LeBron or whoever, take home the lion's share, you know, they get these extraordinary tens of million dollar salaries. We all know this in the Hollywood movies or in music. You know, Taylor Swift or Beyonce, you know, capture a whole large amount of sales, and they have, you know, make a tons of money. And the movies, you know, The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, or another megastar. But what I say in the book is that winner-take-all pattern also goes for cities and metropolitan areas, that there are winners and there are losers. And it's not like the old even geography when I was a boy, that New York and San Francisco and Milwaukee and Detroit and Pittsburgh and Atlanta were all kind of the same, that the winners are gaining more and more and gaining more ground on the rest. And so what one good indicator of this winner-take-all phenomenon, this winner-take-all urbanism, is these venture capital, high-tech, high-flying startups. You know, I've even been able to update the data since the book. New data's come out. The San Francisco Bay Area collects $23 billion in venture capital going to startups each and every year. The next in line is New York with $7 billion. And the next in line in that is Boston. But most communities don't even get $100 million. And in the book I say there are two neighborhoods in downtown San Francisco. They're tiny little neighborhoods, like a Milwaukee downtown neighborhood. Each of those neighborhoods collects more than $1 billion or generates more than $1 billion in these venture capital-backed businesses each and every year. That's more than any other nation on the planet, save for the United States. So this idea that the winners take all, you know, just three metropolitan areas, San Francisco, New York, and Boston, and it's mainly concentrated in the cities, in the areas around universities, have more than two-thirds of all the venture capital-backed startups in the United States and more than half in the world. So that's a winner-take-all. That's what I mean when I say winner-take-all. And I think one ramification of that, one implication of that, is what we saw in the last election, where these kind of blue coastal metros voted for Mrs. Clinton, and the rest of the country, the backlash was, you know, the places that are falling behind, and many of the other places in the country voted for Donald Trump. So I think it's something we see in our lives. It's not just an abstract phenomenon. The winners are pulling away. The rest of us are falling behind, and people are getting angrier and angrier about that.
That's interesting. So in order to be a winner, and let's take a, because I'm sitting smack dab in the middle of Milwaukee right now, and Milwaukee is struggling. It was a city that did very well, you know, some 40 years ago. Great manufacturing, family-supporting jobs, a lot of people at work. Now we face the highest black unemployment rate in the whole country, and we don't have a lot of high-tech companies. But for cities like Milwaukee, who can't attract because we don't have the kind of money, we have a lot of poverty in this city, all those venture capital funds, where do we go? What do we have?
As you may know, I was in Milwaukee recently. I've come several times over the past decade and a half, but you know, it's funny, I kicked off my book tour for the Rise of the Creative Class with a stop in Milwaukee, and then folks were kind enough to invite me back, so I stayed at the Iron Horse Hotel. I got to see the Harley. Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, what's happened in, first of all, let's say the good news. What's happened in Milwaukee over the past 10 or 15 years is remarkable. You know, the hotel was spectacular. Mm-hmm. The whole area was growing and booming. What's happening around Marquette? And, of course, I went downtown. I got a great dinner at a downtown restaurant, went, watched one of the basketball finals were still going on a rooftop, you know, deck. Mm-hmm. People were phenomenal. And you could see that Milwaukee, you know, for all of this year, 20 years now, has revived.
Yes.
Of course, though, Milwaukee, and the other good news, bit of good news, is that you don't have the urban crisis. You know, I have all the metrics in the book, but, you know, to summarize those for folks listening in, you don't have nearly the level of the new urban crisis, of a New York, of a San Francisco, of a Los Angeles, of a Chicago. So one of the points that I think you have to do is not only look for those high-tech great companies, you really got to figure out a way as you develop and grow to make it inclusive so all people in Milwaukee, you know, you mentioned the black concentrated poverty, black unemployment, so that the working class people, everyone can be part of this prosperity and clustering. So I think you want to try to avoid the problems and the great divides of the San Franciscos and the New York and the Los Angeleses and build the kind of economy that benefits many more Milwaukeeans, not just the privileged few.
So what is that economy?
Well, I think the contours of that economy are pretty clear, and it's what's hurt places like Milwaukee. You know, I'm from Newark, New Jersey. My dad was a seventh grade educated blue collar guy, worked in an eyeglass factory his entire life. I lived in Pittsburgh for 20 years. My wife, Rana, she comes from Detroit, Michigan. So we've seen this and lived this personally. So the reality is, despite what our president might like to believe, but the reality is the blue-collar manufacturing jobs are declining and have been declining. And honestly, folks, and I know this is a tough pill to swallow, only 6% of Americans do the kind of factory job my dad did. Now, we have other blue-collar workers in construction work, in mechanical work, in installation work, in transportation work, but about 50% of our workforce did work like my dad. Now 5% of us do. So we've grown two kinds of jobs. One, we've grown these knowledge, professional, and creative, high-paying jobs in science and technology, arts, media, and entertainment, business and management. And Milwaukee has to do as good as it can to attract those jobs. It has to, you know, be better at that. But even if Milwaukee was performing at the national average or a little above, that would still not be good enough because only a third of us do those jobs. Two-thirds of Americans, I shouldn't say that, half of Americans do these low-wage service jobs. They do our food preparation, yes, and food service. They work in retail shops. They take care of our kids. They take care of our aging parents. They work in healthcare support operations. And they toil in low-wage, precarious jobs that in Maine, a lot of women, a lot of ethnic minorities, a lot of immigrants do this work that Americans, some of us, don't want to do. We've got to make those jobs better. So one of the big things we have to do in towns like Milwaukee is not only grow our high-flying tech economy and knowledge economy, we've got to bridge the gap. And you know, I was just talking the other day with folks in San Jose, in the middle of Silicon Valley. They have a project there to attract Google. Google, which had its big corporate complex in the Silicon Valley, now wants to open in the urban area of San Jose, which looks a little bit more like a real city, more like a Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Google pays its engineers $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, whatever, who knows how much. And they pay their cafeteria workers, and they pay their health workers and their daycare workers below, you know, the minimum wage. That's what we've got to change. We've got to make sure that we create the kinds of jobs and transform our service jobs that every town like Milwaukee, like San Jose has. We've got to make them good jobs and turn those jobs in healthcare and retail and food prep into the same kind of good job my dad had in the factory, but for our new economy.
So is there a way, or is this totally off the mark, that you have to link those who are making incredibly large salaries in order to afford living in parts of San Francisco and D.C. and even in Milwaukee? Do those people have to somehow earn less in order for the cafeteria workers to have a living wage? Are they connected or not?
No, I don't think they'd have to earn less. You know, and I think the best analog I can say is we learned this lesson in the Depression. You know, my dad told me this story. Rich, he said, when I was a boy at 13, I had to leave grade school. But I had to go to work with your granddad and your grandma and my six brothers and sisters, working in a factory to make one family wage. It took nine of us. He said, but after he came back, he was an infantry soldier. He stormed the beaches at Normandy, fought in all the great battles of World War II. After I came back from the war, I went back to work in the same factory in the Newark's great manufacturing district, the Ironbound District. As if by magic, I had a great middle-class job. I got married. We bought a home. We had you boys. We put you two boys through Catholic school. They were so proud of that. And put you two boys through college, local university, Rutgers College. We had a union movement, the Wagner Act, collective bargaining. We had the New Deal. And companies and the government in America said, you know, if we're going to make a middle class, we got to turn manufacturing jobs. And if people are going to be able to buy the cars and appliances, those Harleys coming off the assembly line, the workers got to make enough money. It's the same thing. The rich didn't have to sacrifice that much. We all had to pay a little more for a car. But now we can all pay a little bit more and we go to the retail shop. We don't have to pay the least common denominator. Oh, and if we want to, you know, to have health care for our kids, we pay a little more for daycare. We pay a little more for elder care. We pay a little more for the restaurant. We don't go broke, but those of us who are doing well pay a little bit more. And I like to say, you know, I'm not trying to denigrate anything, but who's more important to you in your life? The guy who builds your car, very important, or the person who takes care of your killed or your elder parents?
Right.
Hopefully we don't have to make that choice, but the point is the person who takes care of your kids and your elderly parents is at least as important to me as the person who's made my car, and they're getting the short shrift. So I think we all have to share and pay a little bit more to create a new middle class. And if we do that, we're all going to be better off.
Richard Florida, our guest, his latest book is The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. Our phone number lines are open right now for you. And here's how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. Call in and be just as brilliant as last hour's calls were. It was a great hour for calls last hour. And I assume that this hour will be the same. So we'll be with you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, phone calls now for Richard Florida. He wrote the book that was so well-received and sparked all kinds of conversation a few years ago, The Rise of the Creative Class, and now his latest is The Urban Crisis. And let's go to Randy in Madison for our first call. Hi, Randy.
Good afternoon. In all the postmortems, whatever, of this last election, a lot of people really laid into the Democratic Party for paying lip service to the service and blue-collar voters, but falling all over themselves to please the creative class that you celebrate. And a few people said that actually they're not just different groups, they're oppositional groups, that that the creative class, for it to fare well, the other group has to harm, and presumably vice versa. I was just wondering if you've observed that yourself.
What a great question.
Yes.
And what an important question. And I've written a lot on that, and have written more. And, in fact, Tom Edsel wrote a piece in the New York Times covering some of my initial research. So here's what I think, and it's the picture. It is what it is. I don't want to put a value judgment on it. If you look at the knowledge worker, the professional worker, the creative class, and where they live, their locations, their county locations or their metropolitan locations, those locations over the past 10 or 15 years have voted consistently blue and consistently Democratic. And there is a high correlation, a high statistical correlation between the locations like Madison or Ann Arbor or San Francisco, San Jose, New York, with large concentrations and Democratic votes. Those correlations have increased somewhat on the past election. In other words, from Obama to Clinton, they rose a bit. But the correlations have been relatively stable over time. On the other hand, if you take the areas that have a blue-collar working class, large population, large concentration, those places have voted consistently and predictably for Republicans. Yes, the correlation is a little higher for Trump than it was for Romney, but it's quite similar in magnitude. The group that is the outlier here, and where I think the Democrats, and I've written about this, Tom Edsel covered me on this, we're going to be writing more on this, where I think the Democrats have to go is they have to focus on the service class, these equivalent of blue-collar workers, largely women, predominantly women, working in these caring professions, working in the food service and prep, health care support, personal care, these kinds of things. The correlation for Obama was a very nearly insignificant 0.1, very low, and it was completely insignificant in the current election for both candidates. So these are the swing voters, and these are the swing places, and it seems to me that the Democrats could build a cross-class coalition of the knowledge workers and the service workers, but they have to embrace what I think you would call inclusive prosperity. They have to come out hard-hitting for a higher minimum wage. They have to come out hard-hitting for protection for those service jobs and better protections for those service workers. They have to come out hard-hitting for more affordable housing. And what we find is that in these creative class locales, there's actually support for those kinds of things. So the bigger point, I don't want to go on and on ad nauseum, but I think we've got to recognize increasingly that we're two countries. And I've written a lot about this, and we can talk more, Kathleen, if you like, and that what may play in blue America may not play in red America. And we can't keep fighting each other forever, so maybe we've got to decide to devolve power away from Washington down to our cities and states and give our cities and states and our communities, our suburbs and rural areas more power to govern themselves, because I'm just worried that, to be quite honest, as someone who's very far left by American terms, very far left Democrat, that the blue part of America is losing. It's losing out in the Electoral College. And there may be a way to create some kind of peace, more peaceful accommodation between blue and red America.
Interesting. And certainly mayors, it was an interesting conference of mayors that took place in Miami Beach. The Times had an interesting piece yesterday about how they really are taking the lead on climate change, because they have to take the lead on climate change. And you hear so much about mayors all over the country who are taking the lead on housing issues and on the very things that you think need to be addressed that probably this current administration will not be addressing.
Well, I was there in Miami Beach.
Oh, were you?
The mayors. Yeah, I was there.
How was that?
It was wonderful. It was uplifting. I gave one of the opening keynotes.
Oh, you did. Oh,
so
great.
And for folks listening, and I have an essay on this in the Politico magazine. But one of the things that I tried to argue is that you guys are the future. You guys and women. You are the place that Americans look for leadership on climate, and we have to extend that to, as you said, Kathleen, housing, job creation, what I'm calling urbanism for all or inclusive prosperity. And one of the things I wanted to mention is, if you look at the faith and confidence that Americans have in our federal government, that was when I was a kid in the 60s, 3/4 of us believed and had trust and faith and confidence in our federal government. Now, depending on the survey you look at, it's between 1/3 and 20%, and in Donald Trump's case, it's under 20%. But our trust and confidence in state and local government is at record highs. And at the state level, it's about half of us. At the local level, 3/4 of us believe, have trust and confidence in our mayor, in our community government. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think one is there's not a Republican or Democratic way to run a city or a community. You do what's best for your people. You're closer to them. But moreover, Americans get to vote with their feet. And if I want to live in a place that spends more on transit, that has a better record on diversity and tolerance, that embraces women and gay rights, that spends more on knowledge-based institutions and more on public parks and public goods, I can elect to live there. If I'm a more conservative person who wants a lower tax rate and has other beliefs, I can pick where I want to live. So in a way, we have to realize that we are different nations, that we are urban, suburban, and rural. We are red and blue. And if we can empower our localities to do more, we'd be a lot happier as a country. And the stakes in this every 4 or 8 year tumultuous kind of political version of a modest civil war that we have would be reduced. So I think this is going to be the big trend we see as well. I think that as we move to a kind of a newer economy and newer kind of way of living and working, we're going to have to move power from the feds down. And it's something, yes, that I've tried to work on a lot. And I give Mayor Bloomberg credit. You know, part of what he did is he created another $200 million initiative to fund cities and to fund their abilities to address these things. So yeah, I think this is where we're going to have to head in the future as a nation.
Richard, did you pick Toronto?
Did I pick Toronto?
Yes.
I did.
You did. Why?
Well, you know, this is a great question, Kathleen. So I was living in Pittsburgh for nearly 20 years, and I love Pittsburgh. And, you know, I was thinking after 20 years in a place, maybe I should take a look and make a change. And I literally took out a piece of paper, and I put all these categories of things, a great university, great research center, a great city, diverse population. And, you know, if you had asked me, what would have come out on top, because I grew up in the shadow of New York, I would have said New York came up number one, and L.A. would be at the bottom. Actually, Washington, D.C. and Toronto came out very high, and subsequently I went on, just through luck of opportunity, to work in both those cities. New York came down slightly lower in the list, and L.A. came up quite high. So I actually wrote a book. I called it Who's Your City? I wrote a book about how you pick the place you live. But in my case, you know, it was a great university, a great city. And by the way, my wife, as I mentioned, is from Michigan. So for us, Toronto is a 3.5-hour drive from her family and my now dozen nieces and nephews. Mm-hmm. And we have two little ones. So it made sense for us as a family.
Yes.
It's also been good for me in the fact that I think living in Toronto has helped me appreciate both the great things about America and some of the warts on America better. I think living even though it's close by, in a city that's in North America, close by the United States, but in a different country, has made me to come to understand my own home country a little bit better.
Oh, fascinating. I haven't been there in so many years. I think I'll pay a visit sometime soon. Randy.
Come visit. Two things I want to mention that you guys will find. Well, three. One, we are home to Drake and The Weeknd. So on the popular culture front, you know, you've got your fill there. But the second thing is, you know, Toronto has an incredible thing because you think of a city that has great schools, great neighborhoods, very little violence, very little gun crime. So it's good for Americans to see that. But the third thing is, it's quite daunting, is Toronto is right smack in the middle of this new urban crisis. The median price of a home, that home could be attached or detached. It's a townhouse or a single-family home. Folks in Milwaukee, get ready. Mm-hmm. The median price is $1.5 million.
Oh, my gosh.
Exactly. So even in a place like Toronto, you're seeing the same kind of new urban crisis that you see in San Francisco or New York or some of these other places.
Whew. Well, Randy, thanks so much for your interesting call. Let's go to Ann in Green Bay. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I would just like to say some of this is political, Will, because you talk about paying $15 an hour, and the political rhetoric is that, oh, it's going to break the economy, businesses are going to go out of business, and that's just not true. This will stimulate the economy and just create more jobs, because when people have money to spend, they spend it.
100% agree. First of all, I think we need a minimum wage that's indexed to the local cost of living, and that would be perhaps lower in Green Bay and Milwaukee, but quite a living wage compared to what it would be in San Francisco and New York. But one of the things we've been doing is working with so-called anchor institutions, because there's not going to be a federal urban policy, not going to be anything. And in many states, there's not going to be state assistance for cities. The state legislature doesn't care. There's no political will. But who does care? Large corporations, universities, high-tech companies, real estate developers. So what's been so heartening to me, you know, somebody who saw my first book talk a couple of months ago and then went to see me a week ago said, you've become so much more optimistic. And I said, that's because I've been in Milwaukee. I've been in Indianapolis. I've been in Columbus, Ohio. I've been in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I went down the list. And every place I go, there are people working to build better and stronger and more inclusive cities. But it's going to be up to our local governments and our anchor institutions, our great universities, our great corporations, to say we're going to be part of the solution. And every place I go, a university president, a local corporate leader, a high-tech entrepreneur comes up to me and says, I understand this. We need the political will. Will it be easy? No. But what gives me optimism is if we could bring back not just Chicago and not just New York and not just Milwaukee, if we could bring back Pittsburgh and Detroit, and that's not perfect, and there's still plenty of work to do on that front, but if we can bring back those urban cores like what you've achieved in Milwaukee, going the next step and including more people in this revival, we can do that too over the next 10 or 15 years. But there's not going to be any federal or state programs that help us get there. We're going to have to do it on our own.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ann, for the call. Michael in Danbury. Hi, Michael.
Hi, and thank you for listening. Your comments are really very interesting. My concern is that since the white community in the United States is becoming the minority, why aren't we focusing programs on making sure that the quality of education and the development of people of color in this country is really the focus of fulfilling the employment requirements, and especially the educated employment requirements?
Well, I think you've just given us an explanation for the populist backlash, which is many people consider it to be about the economic inequality and the economic gap, which is part of it, but really is a cultural backlash to the rise of women, the rise of the gay community, the rise of minorities, the share of our population. And it's, you know, really what we're seeing in America play out is a conflict between more tolerant, more open-minded, more progressive urban places and older communities, which really want to see us go back to family values. So I think the big issue on the agenda of America ahead is how do we make sure that all Americans are equipped to participate in the knowledge economy? And since our fastest growing groups of Americans are immigrants, are ethnic and racial minorities, women are playing such a big role in the service economy, this has to be at the top of our list. And one of the things I worry when we talk about sort of placating or reaching back out to some of the places being left behind, and I want to help everyone, is I don't want to go back on the progress we've made on more progressive, more tolerant, more open-minded and inclusive values. And that's where, as I think I said before, organizing this service class, developing programs which can help them, developing programs which reach out to women who are heading families working in these jobs, ethnic and racial minorities, new immigrant groups, are the kind of things one or the other party, but hopefully the Democrats could try to do more of. But I think you're right. The divide in our country crosses race, it crosses class, it crosses values, and it crosses locations. And it's unfortunately getting wider and wider. It's not healing itself, you know. For the first time, I'm really afraid it's going to be hard to heal America.
Mm. I want to talk a little more about expanding this middle class and expanding those low wage wages to allow people to move forward some. Who is it up to? Who's doing that? It seems like this has been going on for years, Richard, and I don't know who's paying a lot of attention. There are some cities that have raised their minimum wage, and I know that's helped some people, but it's not the whole country doing that. So where's the impetus for it? Who's leading the charge?
So I think it's the reason why I'm becoming more optimistic. So please, folks, don't make me more pessimistic today in Milwaukee. But I think the reason is really the election. And it's not just that Trump was elected president, regardless of whether you like Trump or not. I think that's part of it, that many Americans and many business leaders see a person as president who might not be up to the job. There are many Republicans who may feel this way. But the bigger issue is that many, many, many people see this divide now as terrifying. And I think this has spurred a level of conversation among business leaders, the tech community, real estate developers, state and local government that I've never seen before.
Really?
You know, people before were just like, oh, it'll take care of itself. The federal government will help it. Maybe they'll do this or that. Now I see people saying, we've got to fix this darn thing before it rips us apart. So obviously I think some of the big cities are leading. You know, Seattle has made a big move on the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been some debate about how effective that is. Did they raise it too high? L.A., Los Angeles, in San Francisco, there's been a big push on affordable housing. Of course, Mayor de Blasio in New York has done the same. So I think there's a lot of action taking place. And really now, you know, it's up to folks like me and others to try to make the case that we have to bring this all together. We have to create affordable housing. We have to invest in transit. We have to upgrade jobs. So I think it's a movement that's now gaining steam. And, you know, I mentioned being in Miami Beach. One of the mayors came up to me after I was so privileged to speak to this group of people who give us such hope and faith. He said to me, you know, I want to start with your help. You can help me. A group on inclusive prosperity and job upgrading that's equivalent to what we've done on climate change. So, you know, where you said that these hundreds of mayors have banded together to say if the United States doesn't want to support a better climate, we will do it.
Yes.
He wants to do the same thing for inclusive prosperity and job upgrading. And I think that's the kind of movement we need to have from the bottom up. Because you know what? What's going to work in Milwaukee is different than what's going to work in Phoenix, Arizona. What's going to work
sure.
in Phoenix, Arizona is really different than what's going to work in Detroit. What San Francisco and New York need to do is really different than what Milwaukee or Birmingham need to do. So, in fact, each one of us has to do the things that fits our community best.
Our guest this hour is Richard Florida. His latest book is The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. Our phone number, one line is open, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. We'll return to you and Richard in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, back to phone calls. William in Madison. Hi, William.
Hi.
Hi.
I have one question for the for your guest today.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about the all the money being poured into San Francisco, what's so attractive about San Francisco with the higher, you know, how much it costs to live there? Why is all the money going to that city versus other really nice places around the United States?
Hmm.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, William.
I mean, that is the big, big question, and the one that stands at the center of my book, The New Urban Crisis. What's driving this is what's behind what I call this winner-take-all system. Talented people, innovative companies, they all kind of cluster around one another, and it's the great paradox of modern society. Just at the time when we think we've overcome distance, we have planes and, you know, fast internet connections, and we can connect anywhere around the globe, this clustering of activity gets more and more. That's what's creating these superstars in fields like finance or tech, or you even see it in music. You know, you think about an area where you don't have to be around a big factory, you don't have to be around a big port, you're a musician. Musicians are so clustered in New York and Los Angeles and then Nashville, Tennessee, even more so than the techies in San Francisco. So it's really what I call this clustering effect. It doesn't matter how much you have to pay to live there. If you want to work in tech, you kind of have to be there. If you want to work in finance, you have to be in New York or London. If you want to do music in New York or L.A. or Nashville. And what happens then is the people who are doing fine in those industries or are wealthy get to stay in those communities, and the people who are doing less well, the service workers, the low-income people, and increasingly the middle class, are then pushed out either to the far reaches of the suburbs where their commutes are an hour or more, or they're pushed out to other metros. So the argument I make in the book is that the nub of the crisis we face is the same, very same clustering of people, of talent, of innovation that drives our economy and powers its growth, are carving the big divides that we see in our society and generating the kind of political backlash effect that unfortunately we're all living with. Mm.
There's another corridor. What's the statistic you cite in the book? The whole eastern from, what, Boston down to Washington, D.C., and the corner they have on the whole world market. Is it on tech?
Yeah, it's this Boston, New York, Washington corridor, which is, you know, 55 million people, over $2.5 trillion in economic output, and really, they have a high share of tech, not as big as the Bay Area, but if you take finance and media and entertainment and technology together, it's just a mega region. So in a way, it explains our bi-coastal economy and what's wrong with it.
Right.
And partly we have to shore up the middle of our country, and partly we have to address these divides that winner-take-all system is generating.
Let's go to Ray in Milwaukee. Hello, Ray.
Hi, I would like to disagree with your guest where he was saying that we have more faith in local governments. I, as a progressive person, I'm in my mid-50s. I am very angry at Scott Walker and how he has turned teachers in this state into scapegoats for all ills, and he has destroyed their union. And we have a mayor here in Milwaukee who has decided to build a $750 million streetcar to the yuppie east side. Now, here's a divide, all right, when you think of the divide of the city of Milwaukee. The inner city of Milwaukee is completely hollowed out. And if they had run that streetcar starting in the inner city of Milwaukee and ending maybe in Waukesha or Oak Creek or some of the other suburban outlying areas where there are factory jobs for people in the inner city who need jobs, I would have been for this crazy streetcar. But right now we're building it 2 miles, $750 million, and we can't even fix the bad streets in Milwaukee. So I've lost faith in all government, period.
Thanks for your call, Ray. Richard.
I was asking you, Milwaukee, please don't make me as pessimistic as I was when I finished the book.
You've been both.
No, I think the points are really well taken, and they are reason for real concern. First of all, I just want to say that I mentioned the fact that I think that the state government is also a big part of the problem, not as big as Trump and the federal government, but I didn't want to call out your own governor. I should have. Who's part of the problem and part of the backlash and part of the backward-looking thinking. So I agree with that. And too many state legislatures, not only governorships, but state legislatures have been anti-urban and in many ways anti-progress for a long time. It's the local level of government that I want to put more faith in, and I think that more Americans trust. Now that comes with risks. And I think, as you said, rightly said, you're not going to agree with local leadership all the time. I live in Toronto. And we elected a real crack mayor, the guy who did crack.
Yes, you did.
Rob Ford,
right.
The original populist, the guy who Trump in many ways modeled himself after. And what I say in the thing that the essay I wrote for Politico and what I said to the mayors and what I say is not every mayor is going to be perfect, but no mayor has his finger on the nuclear trigger, his or her finger on the nuclear trigger either. I could take 5 or 10 or 15 bad mayors at any given time if I got 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 good mayors and a whole bunch of competent mayors. And I think when I look at what the best people have thought about this, if you can empower the local level over time, the competition of places for people, for jobs, for industry, for votes, creates a race to the top among many, many places. So I do think not all mayors get it. I think that we have plenty of mayors, some of whom are drug addicts and dysfunctional, like our own former mayor in Toronto, some of whom are crooked. But I think when we have, you know, thousands and thousands of communities across America, many of them that have good mayors and are trying to do the right things, over time the system is much more robust and resilient by having all of that innovation than putting the power either in 50 governors or, worse yet, one god darn president who's got control over, you know, our future. I think we have to make better use of all the different levels of government we have. And I agree, though, it's not the local government doesn't do everything right all the time, and they can make big mistakes. But we just have to figure out that as a country, with having many local governments, all of them trying to innovate, over time we'll get there.
And you also have to have a certain amount of cooperation between state government and city government around the country, because the state has funds, right? They have money to, if they're going to put a streetcar of some kind to go out to Waukesha where the jobs are, all that money can't come from the city of Milwaukee. It has to be, well, we're in this together.
And I think the cities and communities need to keep more money. You know, we're where the money comes from. The money comes from us, and we pay taxes that goes to the state and the federal level. Maybe instead of that, and then them trying to give money back to us, maybe the better solution is for the money to stay closer to the source of the problem and the source of the solution, to stay closer to home. And I think, you know, one of the things we talked to the mayors about in this budding movement of mayors, there, you know, there's the chairman of the mayor's group is Mick Cornett, a fantastic Republican from Oklahoma City. The vice chairman, now incoming chairman, is a Democrat mayor, Mayor Mitch Landrieu from New Orleans. This can be a bipartisan thing. This doesn't have to be a partisan divide, you know, and Republicans in this country have all been about local control for a long time. So I think it's about letting us keep the money, not sending it up to the state and federal government, letting us keep our money and use the money the way we see fit.
Thanks very much, Ray, for the call. Let's go to Jay next in Black River Falls. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to Mr. Florida. I just finished reading three of his books.
Oh, great.
The last one being The Great Reset. And I wanted to ask a question, actually a couple of questions, but to be brief, he puts out in this Great Reset, which was written right after the big Great Recession in 2009-10, I believe, and he puts out a need for a new economy that reflects changes that need to be brought about to avoid those types of things as they might progress. So my question is, in the succeeding 7 years, have we made progress towards that? I'm listening now, and it's becoming very hard for me to believe that we're really getting to where we need to be in order to accomplish that Great Reset.
I think we're still in it. I think we've made great progress. Unless our federal government undoes it now with clampdown on immigration and anti-innovation and an anti-urban stance. But I think we've made great progress to building a very strong knowledge-based and urban economy. I think the problem is the divide between that and the rest of the country has just gotten unfathomably large. And we've done it without addressing the issues of inclusion, of building a better integrated, a more cohesive economy. So I think that's the next step we have to take. And I think that's become extremely visible in the past 7 years, that the divide has not healed itself, that any progress we've made on innovation in science and technology, you know, the thing I point out in this new book, where is inequality the worst in America? Where is economic segregation the worst in America? Where is the middle class decline the most in America? In our largest, our densest, our most innovative, our most talent-driven, our most knowledge-based economies. And so we can't say that we want to stop that, because it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Why would we destroy the sources of innovation and productivity and jobs? We just have to do something in addition to make sure that the gains from that knowledge economy are more widely distributed and more widely shared.
Richard, a pleasure to have you on the air. Thank you very much.
You mean we're out of time?
We're out of time. I know. It zipped on by, didn't it? I know. Thanks, Richard.
I hope to be coming back to Milwaukee in the near future. Thanks for having me on, and it's always a pleasure to visit your great city.
Great, thanks. Call us, and we'll show you around even more. Richard Florida, his latest book is The New Urban Crisis, How Our Cities Are Increasing Inequality, Deepening Segregation, and Failing the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. He is a university professor and the director of cities at the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto, which is where he now lives. Thanks very much to Gretchen Brown and Colleen Leahy for production of this program. Thanks, everybody, for all of your... You guys were on top of it with phone calls today. Great contributions. Not that they always aren't really good, but today, you know, they went all the way up to eight. Great. Thanks ever so much for listening, and we'll be with you again mañana at 1:00.